Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The FBI has concluded that an Army scientist acted alone in anthrax attacks that killed 5 and injured 17 in 2001. Senators Obama and McCain have taken off the gloves over energy and celebrity, and some Democrats fear disgruntled Hillary Clinton supporters may cause a ruckus at their party's upcoming convention. Joining me to talk about these stories and more on the Friday News Roundup, Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine, National Review's Byron York, and Ruth Marcus of The Washington Post. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Please send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Ruth Marcus, the FBI laid out its case against Army scientist Bruce Ivins. Tell us briefly some of the key findings.
Well, the FBI says essentially they found the murder weapon, and the murder weapon was a flask of anthrax that was in Bruce Ivins' control and that precisely matched, they said, the anthrax spores that killed 5 people. Now, they had other evidence as well. They had a little bit of a motive that they posited, which was that Bruce Ivins was worried about the complaints about an anthrax vaccine that he had worked on, whether it was causing people to be sick and perhaps making people come down with anthrax would be a way to revive interest in the vaccine. They also had a very serious history of very serious mental problems that he had. However, what they did not have was any handwriting samples from him, which I thought was a very odd omission. In other words, handwriting analysis that matched the letters that were sent to various folks. They didn't have any sighting of him in Princeton, New Jersey, where some of the anthrax letters were mailed, and they didn't have any incriminating evidence, admissions, or anything from him. So I would say right now my assessment is it looks as if I would guess that they have the right man this time. I'm less certain that they have evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that he's the right man.
Karen Tumulty.
Well, of course, the you know, sort of sad and element here is that Dr. Ivins has committed suicide, which means that this will never, all of this evidence will never go to a court of law and go through the regular kind of process that these things do when you are trying to find out if there is a reasonable doubt. And certainly, you know, the government does come to this case with a bad record on its investigation, given what they did do to Stephen Hatfill. And also, the early part of the week before they laid out the evidence was really, you know, dominated with these reports by Dr. Ivins's co-workers that, you know, this was not the man they knew, that he was an upstanding member of the community, to all appearances a stable and responsible individual.
Byron.
Well, I think people would accept this as pretty definitive were it not for the Hatfill case, which the government scientist to whom the government has had to pay $5.8 million for falsely.
I think it's 4.8.
Oh, maybe 4.8.
Yeah.
For,
right.
For falsely, right. Falsely accusing him. But then the other thing is if Ivins is the guy, I mean, it raises huge concerns. I mean, there's just no doubt from what we've seen that he was deeply, deeply troubled. And some would say mad as a hatter. And to have this man close and handling the most dangerous substance in the world in a government facility is really, really troubling.
So this is not over? Do you expect?
Well, they have to convince, first of all, the families of the victims in this case that before there's no further investigation, if they declare this thing closed, they're no longer looking for the anthrax killer, they need to convince people that they've really got the guy. And then, because of Hatfill, they have to have an investigation of their own process in finding Ivins.
There is some hope for closure. The judge overseeing the case approved a search warrant yesterday to look at the computers, at library computers, that Dr. Ivins had visited. So he had looked at apparently an anthrax website, and he had also accessed emails. It may be that we will get something there that will add, you know, a layer of certainty that we don't have. I would make one sort of contrary point on Hatfill. There's no doubt that the FBI messed that up to a fare thee well, and 4.8 million, 5.8 million. They just did this man a terrible, terrible disservice. We have reason, therefore, to be skeptical of them. But I would actually argue that if I were the FBI director, I would be instructing my people, whatever you do, do not mess this up again. And there may have been actually a good abundance of caution in going after Dr. Ivins.
And by the way, this also may not be the end of this case in the legal front either, because, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if there weren't some lawsuits filed by either victims' families or potential victims' families over, you know, what the government's handling of this, and specifically they're, you know, leaving Dr. Ivins in a position where he was working with, you know, potentially deadly substances.
And because Ivins killed himself, you're not going to have this trial. It's short-circuited the process. For example, Ivins' lawyer was saying that this vial that Ruth mentioned, other people had access,
exactly.
He says. Now, that's
exactly.
The kind of thing that you would test in a trial, but we're not going to have that. So it is going to be difficult to bring any final closure to it.
Yes, and I think Byron mentions one more thing that's very, very important, which is the absolutely scarily shoddy process of making certain that the people with access to this material are people who can be trusted with access to this material.
So can we expect congressional hearings on this?
You bet.
We talked yesterday to Congressman Rush Holt of New Jersey, who said, if I have anything to do with it, there will be hearings, Karen.
Well, and certainly Congressman Rush Holt speaks from a specific perspective in that some of this stuff was being mailed from his district. So, you know, it was his constituents who were sort of on the front lines of this in a lot of ways.
Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine, Ruth Marcus of The Washington Post, Byron York of National Review. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. The campaigns turn their attention to energy issues this week. How much will Barack Obama's change of heart on offshore drilling matter to both his core constituents and, indeed, undecided voters? Karen.
You know, this issue of offshore drilling is like the first issue that has come the Republicans' way in it seems like years. This is an issue where overwhelming majorities of the public are on the side of opening up the continental shelf to
Why?
Offshore drilling. Because people feel as though they're hurting at the pump, you know. It looks like action. Certainly, if you listen to, you know, the scientists and the engineers who do this, they say, well, there would be no more oil online for possibly
30 years.
But still, it is something that the public wants to see happen. And so Barack Obama is in a difficult spot here because he has shifted his position. He has said that he would consider offshore drilling as part of some sort of compromise package, which is, by the way, being floated in Congress, a bipartisan compromise that also includes things like higher fuel efficiency standards and new sources of energy. But I think the Democratic leadership did their presidential nominee a disservice by sending Congress out of town without having acted on an energy bill.
But, of course, you've still got a group of Republicans waiting.
They haven't left town.
And mocking Nancy Pelosi, saying she really ought to be back here, but calling the Congress back into session.
They are indeed, because if you're a member of Congress, you can show up and go on the floor and talk. Maybe
and
the cameras won't be on.
The public
you can invite
in.
The public, which can go onto the floor of the House when it's not in session, which is something that you or I couldn't just do when they were. I think Pelosi has made a huge mistake on this, because if you look at the polls, between two-thirds and three-quarters of the American people favor drilling. There's different sentiment on offshore drilling now than there was in 1981 when this moratorium was first imposed, and you can explain it all by talking about $4 gas. So I think she's done a terrible disservice, which is why she has reportedly told some of her members, I'm going to be against drilling. I'm not going to let this happen, but you're going out to run for re-election. Do what you got to do.
Ruth.
I think that not only is this the first issue that's come the Republicans' way, I agree with Byron. It is an issue that the Democrats have actually hand-delivered to the Republicans. I would fault first Speaker Pelosi for it. It's perfectly legitimate position to be against offshore drilling, certainly if you're from California where that's a big issue. It's a legitimate position. What I thought was not smart, either substantively or politically, about Speaker Pelosi was that she refused to even allow this to come up for a vote. So you had that on the House side. And then on the Senate side, actually, I would say I would take issue with Karen, which is not something I do lightly. But I think that the Senate Democrats found themselves in a tough position because not only were they going up against the Speaker if they thought about a drilling vote, they needed to have the back of their nominee who had staked out a position against drilling. So I'm not sure they failed him. I think he, in some sense, failed them because there was a sense among many of them they needed to back him up. That said, I think he's not so much of a flip-flop as a sensible evolution on drilling, sensible from a political point of view and probably also from a substantive point of view. I would say would have been better if he had managed it a few weeks ago.
This actually reminds me of a situation from the 2000 campaign where George W. Bush, then the governor of Texas, found himself at odds with his congressional leadership over the question of, I believe it was the EITC, where he accused Tom DeLay of trying to balance the budget on the backs of the poor. It worked for him to go against his leadership.
Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine, Ruth Marcus of The Washington Post, Byron York, White House correspondent for National Review. Short break. We'll be right back. And we're back talking about other issues this week, and certainly the campaign with its ads from both sides was interesting, with John McCain characterizing Barack Obama as a celebrity. How effective was that, Karen?
You know, it was effective in that it got into the conversation. These are not sort of ads the way we think of ads, which is the campaign is not spending a lot of money to put these things on the air. What they're counting on and what the media is doing is playing at these things endlessly on cable television and on the internet. And I think they have decided that their strategy is to make this election about Barack Obama and essentially portray him as an empty suit and an elitist.
Do you think it's working, Ruth?
I think certainly in terms of breaking through, which was not something that was very easy for Senator McCain to do while Senator Obama was in Europe and going on. And so we have now turned the conversation, as Karen says, to is Barack Obama a lightweight? And is he, it's a little bit contradictory, but is he a lightweight who's a liberal lightweight? And And, you know, that's given how people feel about the Bush administration, that's not a terrible conversation for the McCain campaign to be driving.
Well, I think it was a strategy driven by necessity. You're running against a guy, and he can attract 75,000 people in a stadium or 200,000 people overseas. You know, what do you do? That seems to indicate that he's somewhat popular. So you say, well, he's just a rock star. He's just a celebrity. He's not really a leader. I think it was mildly effective. I think much more effective for McCain this week has been the whole tire gauge thing, ridiculing Obama on statements that he has made about energy, specifically his whole thing about we could save as much energy as
but
we
it's
would
true.
Get from offshore.
It's true.
Actually, it's not. I will tell you, I brought here from the United States Department of Transportation
Good.
The latest tire inflation guidelines.
Okay.
Have you checked
right.
yours?
It says,
yeah.
Yes, I have. It says fully 27% of passenger cars on U.S. roadways are driven with one or more substantially underinflated tire. It's not that big a thing.
Nobody.
And offshore drilling would, in the long run, yield much more oil than inflating tires properly.
You know, the thing that's so fascinating about this conversation is that if you listen to both candidates and you read their energy plans, you recognize that if you got them behind closed doors and sat them down in a room, they could actually agree rather quickly on a sensible palette of approaches to take. And because of the necessity of political campaignings, each one of them has to lampoon the other side's position so that you have Barack Obama, and I have to say, with the help of John McCain this week, ridiculing McCain for being only for drilling, which, you know, he had an epiphany about drilling. He was against it. Now he's for it. But he's not just for it. He's really, really, really for it. But Senator Obama leaves out all the other pieces of the McCain platform on energy. Conversely, if you listen to Senator McCain, you'd think that Barack Obama looks at people spending $4 a gallon for gas and says, well, just inflate your tires, guys, and good luck to you. That's not what he's doing. And so each side is caricaturing the other. And on the substance of tire gauges, I would say that Byron's right and wrong. He's right that it's not a complete solution.
Of
he's
course
probably
not.
Right that it wouldn't come up with as much oil eventually as you would get from offshore drilling. But he's wrong that it's not a piece of the puzzle.
Exactly.
I didn't say it wasn't a piece of the puzzle. Right. Everyone says that it's a reasonable thing to do.
But you were characterizing it.
I said this was an effective technique to use against Obama, and I believe it has
been.
Well,
could I just say, though, this has been an effective technique in the short run for John McCain, and if it succeeds in damaging Barack Obama's image, it's a smart move. But if somehow Barack Obama gets back on his feet, which he has done any number of times, I think John McCain has run the risk of damaging his own image and his own brand as a different kind of politician, somebody who doesn't sort of practice politics by these kind of ambushes that we've seen. And I think in the long run, if this doesn't work, it's going to hurt McCain.
One of the things that was interesting, I was out on the campaign trail with Senator Obama this week, and he was, just as Byron very smartly pointed out, that Senator McCain was taking the amazing fact of getting 200,000 at a crowd and using that against Senator Obama. Senator Obama was not running away from the celebrity charges. He was going right back at Senator McCain, making fun of the celebrity ad, saying, you know, they have no argument except to compare me to Paris Hilton and Britney Spears, and taking on the tire gauges and making fun of that. So you have two campaigns that have both been just kind of going straight at each other this week.
Right.
It's like October.
Let's talk about the report. Senator Clinton wants to have her name on the roll call vote at the Democratic Convention, Byron.
Well, that's the big question. We know she'll be speaking. And did you know that Tuesday of the convention, August 26th, just happens to be Women's Equality Day, which marks the anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment? And so there'll be this big kind of celebration. And she will speak, and everybody, I guess, will feel good about how inclusive they are. And then, after celebrating the right of women to vote, are they then going to deny a vote to the millions of women who supported Hillary Clinton? This has created a real problem for Democratic convention planners.
Yeah, I think it's a sort of larger problem, too, with just the continuing tension between the Obama campaign and both Clintons. This is something that, quite frankly, Hillary Clinton has been tacitly encouraging behind the scenes. And there are a couple of videos right now playing on YouTube where she is specifically asked about this Thursday a week ago at a fundraiser in California. And she does not do anything to discourage the idea and, in fact, portrays it as more of what typically happens. Now, what difference does it make if Hillary Clinton's name is put into nomination? Not a lot, because she's not going to get the nomination, except it will be a big symbolic show of party divisions, not party unity. And it will also eat up airtime. I mean, the conventions have become infomercials, and they want this infomercial to be about party enthusiasm for Barack Obama, not lingering bitterness.
I think that if I had been Senator Obama's campaign, I would have thought again a few weeks ago about embracing the notion of a roll call vote. Why not just say, as Byron pointed out, this is a fantastic moment. We have this historic situation with the first female candidate on the verge of a nomination and the first African-American candidate who's gotten it. Why not embrace a roll call vote and say, everybody, you know, express your sense of excitement and solidarity, and then we can all move on and coalesce around Senator Obama?
Are there still meetings going on between the two camps?
I believe there are, and we've seen some edging towards at least temporary unity this week. Senator Clinton is getting what she wanted in terms of the absolute primetime speaking spot on Tuesday. President Clinton will be speaking the next day. That had been up in the air. So there's a little bit of kind of strategic griping going on the Clinton side of the ledger.
Ruth, don't you think that a roll call vote would just emphasize the fact that it was close, that she got 18 million votes and 1,900 delegates?
Why not just go for it and embrace it? Because what's the alternative? One thing that actually we may see is the potential of no roll call vote, because that's not actually required.
Huh. But also it would emphasize how close it was, and it would also emphasize the fact that apparently she's not going to be on the ticket, despite it being close.
Now, one last question about the Obama campaign. Why is his Muslim affairs advisor leaving the campaign?
Well, he was a volunteer, and he's leaving the campaign because he served on the board of a financial fund with a man who was an unindicted co-conspirator in a conspiracy case to give money to Hamas. So I think the case, this whole issue is not a very big story in itself, but it does, I think, indicate a certain amount of sensitivity in Obama circles for anything Muslim. And so this, from what we know now, this does not seem like a major taint on this fellow. It's just that even the slightest thing, he wanted to pull away and not cause any problems for the Obama campaign.
Okay. And turning to the Republican convention, there are reports that Vice President Dick Cheney is not going. Karen.
Yeah, I think that, you know, bringing in the most unpopular reminder in the country of the Bush administration and the, you know, page that people now say they want to turn in the polls, it's probably a smart move. And it was probably smart of them to announce this now rather than have people suddenly notice that he wasn't there.
Anybody else of the Republicans
I think
going?
Putting the vice president in a secure, undisclosed location for the duration of the convention is good for the Republican Party.
But there are also six other Republican senators who are not going. Ted Stevens of Alaska, Gordon Smith of Oregon, Elizabeth Dole of North Carolina, Susan Collins of Maine. I gather they all face tough elections.
That's right. But, you know, that's not unusual for senators who are in the middle of a tough race to decide not to go to a convention, because what they don't want their they don't want their constituents at home seeing them hanging out with people in funny hats, as opposed to being at home campaigning and acting like they really care about the race.
Because conventions for them are largely going to parties and
hanging
out with people.
Let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. First to Vincent. He's in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I don't know if you've covered this earlier on, but I just want to talk about two incidences of Senator McCain's hypocrisy. One is the DHL scandal in Ohio, where his campaign manager, Rick Davis, lobbied for a German group that bought the DHL group, and now they want to close down the installation there with 8,000 jobs gone. And then the second thing of hypocrisy I want to talk about is why any woman or family value Christian would vote for McCain is beyond me. He basically, after his wife, his first wife, Carol, had waited for him while he was in the Hanoi Hilton, she was actually a bathing beauty beforehand. McCain has an eye for a good-looking woman, nothing wrong with that. And but she unfortunately had an accident that left her crippled for a long time. And he had many, many affairs and ended up having an adulterous affair with Cindy McCain.
Vincent, you know, I'm not sure how we know all of those personal details, but let's talk about that DHL group in Ohio, Ruth Marcus.
Well, I think certainly in a place like Ohio, where everybody's hurting and where jobs seem to be fleeing every day, that that is a political problem for Senator McCain, given that Rick Davis lobbied for this group. But I would note, actually, that the jobs seem to have gone, if I read everything correctly, to North Carolina. So I think everybody gets a little bit more worked up about these
things.
One
swing state to another.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And Karen.
Well, the other issue is Senator McCain himself was in favor of the foreign acquisition of DHL, but that is completely consistent with his free trade philosophy. It is an uncomfortable issue for him in Ohio, and I was in fact traveling with his campaign in early July when somebody from this community got up and burst into tears talking about what this is going to do. But again, it's completely consistent. It's not hypocritical with his overall free trade philosophy.
All right, let's go to Little Rock, Arkansas. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Diane. Did you notice how when gas prices were going up, it was because of increased demand in India and China? And now that they're coming back down, as they always do before an election, it's because we're using less gas in the United States. I think this whole gas price thing has been part of the agenda of this administration from the get-go. I think it's a contrived set-up thing. They jacked up the gas prices to sway public sentiment toward being in favor of offshore drilling and drilling in Anwar. And I think it's all a big hoax being perpetrated on the American people.
Well, that's one view.
Well, I was with him for a while there. I mean, it is true. Gas prices got, I think, to 147,
right.
And now they are at 118.
Uh-huh.
And one point I think this makes is that it undermines one main part of the Democratic position on this, which is the role of speculators. And Democrats in Congress seem to be blaming speculators for the increase in gas prices, and now that they've decreased substantially, still way above where they were, a couple of years ago, but they've decreased substantially. Where have the speculators gone?
Well, also the overall slowing of the economy. It's a chicken egg thing because part of it's being caused by energy prices, but that also is a big factor here. And I don't think that is just somebody behind the scenes manipulating gas prices.
The notion that it's in the Bush administration's and the Republican Party's political interest to drive gas prices up to $4 a gallon is not one that makes intuitive sense to me.
Here's an interesting email from June in Salt Lake City. She says there are two steps to prove the Ivan's anthrax mailing list. One, the anthrax mailed must match the flask in Ivan's lab. This we can successfully investigate. How good is the match? This is the question of sensitivity. And two, are there any other matches in other labs? Typically, strains are shared within the scientific community. I've not heard anything about how the FBI investigated the issue of anthrax strains in other labs that had been sent the Ivan strain. This is the question of specificity. Are there other matches just as good out there?
Well, I'm no microbiologist, but I'll play one for the moment on the radio. What the FBI says is that they have had essentially advances in testing that allow them to precisely match this strain of anthrax to the flask that they call the murder weapon. It is true, as we mentioned earlier, that there are other folks who had access to that flask. The FBI says they've ruled them out. It may also be true that spores from that flask were shared with other researchers, and so that has to be tracked down as well.
So there are still lots of questions out there.
Well, as I said before, this is what a trial would have tested.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
I don't think we're going to have a full-scale test of that without a defendant. And so I don't think we're going to get fully to the bottom of that.
Byron York, White House correspondent for National Review and author of The Vast Left-Wing Conspiracy. We'll take just a short break. When we come back, more of your questions, your phone calls, and email. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the American College of Medical Genetics, ACMG, translating genes into health at acmg.net. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And from the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Friday News Roundup. Osama bin Laden's former driver is sentenced to 5.5 years in prison. President Bush arrives in China for the opening ceremony of the Summer Olympic Games, and the Iraqi government reportedly has a multi-billion-dollar budget surplus. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back to our Friday News Roundup. We'll go right back to the phones to Austin, Texas. Good morning, Israel. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Can you hear me?
Sure can.
Listen, I have two comments I'd like to get your guest reaction to. The first has to do with offshore and Anwar drilling.
Okay.
The comment is that we talk about that as if, one, it's going to be an instant return on the investment of resources to get at the oil. It's as though the $4 plus gallon gas is going to be impacted immediately, and we'll all see happier days as far as the cost of gasoline and diesel is concerned. That's just not true. And then we also talk as if that oil is going to be only Americans. My understanding is that no matter who drills, we are nationalizing the oil companies as a country, and therefore that oil will go into the global marketplace and be subject to being used by everybody.
I don't know about nationalizing the oil companies, but it certainly will. That oil would go on to the global market, Ruth.
Precisely. There is a world price of oil that, so the oil, whatever oil is out there, all settles at the same price. And so there is no such thing as American oil that goes to America. We would be sharing the bounty of this oil in terms of the lower prices that theoretically would result when we drill it with the entire world. But Israel does have a very good point on the question also of the instant return, because it will take some time to get this drilling started, if it does start, and it is always speculative. And so you get arguments about 7 years, 10 years, 30 years. There is some theory that you could, because of the anticipated lowering, that you could have a slightly positive effect sooner rather than later. But anybody who thinks this is an instant gratification solution is deluding themselves. On the other hand, if it does make sense, it does. You do have to start it sometime.
All right, let's go to Hamilton, Ohio. Anne, you're on the air.
Hi, I also am calling to talk about offshore drilling. I'm one of the one quarter to one third of the country that's still against it. And I think it's a red herring political issue, and I'm a little upset that the Democrats aren't doing more to educate the public about how little return we're likely to get from this, both in the near term and potentially in the long term. Whereas if we put the same investment dollars into the kinds of things that Senator Obama is advocating, the long-term return on our money would be so much better and push us so much farther towards energy independence that much faster.
Karen.
And by the way, it also is probably worth bringing up another argument that Senator Obama makes on the campaign trail, which is that the oil companies aren't using all the leases they've already got.
Some 88 million acres out there.
But I've got to tell you, I do not think that at a time when people are so freaked out over the price of gas, that making these kind of, you know, left side of the ledger versus right side of the ledger kind of arguments are going to get
Why
you
not?
Very far. Because I think that people are responding to an intense amount of pain, and they're responding to it emotionally, and they feel like, well, if it would help at all, let's do it.
But I do agree with Anne that there has not been sufficient education out there to the American public so that they understand that offshore drilling is speculative, that it may or may not yield a great deal of oil, and that it could take years. Byron.
Well, first of all, Senator McCain's, he calls his energy program the all of the above program, in the sense that he advocates all of these things.
Well, does not know Obama?
Well, if you read Obama's energy platform, I mean, I would disagree with something Ruth said earlier. I think there's substantial differences between them, certainly of emphases. What Obama says about nuclear power is extremely vague. He clearly does not want
anything.
Wait,
that's electricity, though, not gasoline. So, you know.
Well, it's an energy plan.
Well.
And McCain is talking about building 45 million new plants. McCain is talking about drilling. Obama has, as we've talked about, has kind of flipped a little bit on that, but is still very weak on that. And the things that he's talking about, first of all, we haven't mentioned the $1,000 energy rebate he plans to give to people paid for by a tax on the so-called excess or windfall profits of the oil companies. And then everything else is very, very long-term and speculative.
Byron,
I mean, we're talking about
battery
technology, solar technology, wind technology. Some of this stuff is not going to work out, so it's speculative just as drilling is.
I think that Henry in Margate, Florida, says that you should be careful, because he says this is the second time this week I'm hearing on this show that Barack Obama switched his position to now support offshore drilling. You have failed to mention that John McCain totally switched from being against offshore drilling to now support offshore drilling.
Well, that's correct. That's one of those arguments that a politician makes based on change conditions, that, you know, when gas was $1.50, I didn't support it. When it's $4.50, I do support it.
Ruth.
I think he's right. I think we did earlier make clear that Senator Obama wasn't going out there and wanting to, you know, build the oil well and the coast. but that he has said he will accept it as a part, and that Senator McCain, as Byron said, has said, yes, I've changed it because of changed circumstances. To get back to their energy programs, certainly there are differences in emphases. And I would say one of the, but I think they both have talked in much more global terms about an array of approaches than you could tell from the campaign trail. I think one very big difference is the emphasis on nuclear power, 45 new plants, which is what Senator McCain wants. Senator Obama has said he's open to nuclear, but with a lot of caveats, if we can and if it's safe and if we can
and
prove.
And Yucca Mountain and where the
exactly.
Dredges would go, if you will. All right, let's, I still believe that the emphasis on education should come from us, the people who the public relies on to hear all the facts and not just the politics. Let's go to Prince William County, Virginia. Good morning, Tim. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I was just calling about the I'm just wondering, how much is it going to take before the FBI gets seriously called onto the carpet? I mean, the Mounties say they always get their man. The FBI always gets their pork. There's this. This is just one case. And there was the Hatfield case. There was the Richard Jewell case. There was the Brandon Mayfield case. There was the Abdullah Hagazi case. This was a case where the FBI forced a man to confess to being a part of the 9/11 conspiracy because a bellhop said that he owned this aviation radio. And then it later came out that the pilot who owned it came and got it at the hotel. And no one in the FBI suffered any consequences for forcing that false confession out of that Egyptian student.
We ought to also point out the millions of dollars.
Well,
spent.
He is actually. He mentioned a number of cases that had that were all hot political cases involving terrorism. The bombing at the Olympics, the Richard Jewell case, the guy in was it Portland or Seattle who was thought to be connected to the Spanish bombing.
Portland,
yeah. All of those were cases in which the FBI was under heavy, heavy political and media pressure and perhaps cut corners to do this. And I think that. It's clear that Congress is the place that these things get investigated and that there are consequences.
You know, the public doesn't think of the FBI as cutting corners, and that's the difficult part. The trust level drops.
The trust level drops, and the role of Congress is something of a circular role because the FBI feels under enormous pressure both from the public and from Congress.
Sure.
Congress controls its budget, by the way, to get their man. And so that may lead them to take leaps, and then they get the grief that should be gotten when people take leaps that turn out not to be correct.
And beyond that, the FBI was considered one of the major culprits in failing to miss the signals on 9/11. So that also could be something that makes them a little more likely to jump perhaps a little more quickly than they should.
All right, to Maureen in Alexandria, Virginia. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I'm a member of JustSayNoDeal.com. It is an internet grassroots organization that has been working on behalf of, but not at the direction of, Hillary Clinton to try to ensure her fair treatment at the Democratic National Convention in Denver in August.
And Maureen, outline for us, if you would, what you would see as fair treatment at the convention.
I would, at the minimum, like to see, as the members of the coalition would like to see, millions for that matter, I would like to see her name placed in nomination for a roll call vote of all pledged and non-pledged, therefore superdelegate votes, on the convention floor, that her name be there for any pledged or superdelegate to vote for. As of this point in time, approximately, according to the information coming through the JustSayNoDeal.com coalition, approximately 200 of the superdelegate names needed to be on petition for her name to be put in nomination with her request, that the letter she needs to write has to include 300 superdelegate names on it. She's got 200 of the 300 that she needs. And this is all due to the JustSayNoDeal.com coalition, not the Hillary Clinton campaign, at least not overtly. And there's been a tremendous lack of coverage on this, and I'd like your commenters to comment. I'll take my comment off the air. Thank you.
I appreciate your call, Maureen. Ruth.
It's my understanding that Senator Clinton herself would have to request that and sign that letter, and that's a very big if at this point. She may have certain arrangements with Senator Obama, for example, to help her with fundraising that might lead her to just say no to the Just Say No Deal folks.
Although she made an interesting point on this video that's now circulating at this fundraiser last week, where she said the delegates can do this on their own. They don't need permission. Now, I don't know what the exact party machinery is here, but it was something that she said very explicitly.
And look, it just shows that Maureen just shows that there are a number of Clinton supporters who are not over it. They have strong feelings
Absolutely.
About this. And then the question is going to be, with Obama in the general election, what will their enthusiasm level be? Will there be some of them who just won't vote? I doubt there'll be many to vote for McCain, but there could be people sitting on their hands.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning. I just want to make a couple comments.
Sure.
One is I completely agree with you, Diane, in that the Democrats fumbled this oil issue and they did not educate the public, so to speak. I mean, it's proven, according to the EIA, that there is only 21 billion proven barrels of oil out there. We have a consumption rate in this country of 7.5 billion barrels of oil a year. So what, we got 3 years of oil in this country? Let's say we start drilling. Let's say there's 20 oil rigs we put online immediately, which is, from an infrastructure point of view, is nearly impossible. What's to stop the OPEC nations from reducing their consumption to stabilize the price of oil on a global level?
Good question.
Well, there's never anything to stop OPEC or Venezuela or Russia or anybody from doing whatever they want as far as their production is concerned. I think the fallacy here is that people are talking as if there's some sort of instant fix, and they're all really rather long-term fixes. I do think we've seen the market go down in part because, in addition to the various conservation or world instability, there's an emotional level to markets in the short run.
Sure.
And there was, I think, an emotional component to the run-up of oil recently. But these are all long-term solutions.
Here's an email from Adrian in Jacksonville, Florida, who says, I'm frustrated with people blowing off, checking tire pressure, fuel and air filters, and all the little things people need to do to conserve energy. Just like my dad drilled into me when I was little, when you leave the room, turn out the lights. Sure, it probably only saved a few dollars a year, but every little thing each person does helps in the greater scheme of things. What if every person in the U.S. dropped one piece of paper on the ground every day? Yes, it's only one piece of paper, but it starts to add up very quickly. Ruth Marcus?
I'm smiling because my dad used to try to drill
Absolutely.
The same into me, and it didn't work. And now my husband seems to be equally frustrated with my failure to turn off the lights. So I'm going to try. Clearly, everybody understands that conservation measures really can make a difference. In my office now, we have little signs up. Did you turn off your computer? Did you turn off your lights? Did you turn off in the winter your space heater? We all need to be more attentive to things like that. And that doesn't sort of turn you into Jimmy Carter in the cardigan looking cold and telling everybody they have to feel the pain.
I tell my husband that all the time. Put a sweater on.
And I do want to get back to one thing that Byron mentioned, which I think actually Senator Obama has not gotten nearly enough grief for, which has to do with the windfall profits tax. This is an enormously expensive undertaking, by the way. It's 60, the idea of giving everybody $1,000, not everybody, but people who make up to very significant incomes, it starts to phase out at $150,000, or it phases out at $150,000 for a family. This is a $65 billion a year cost.
And he wants to take it from windfall profits.
To be paid for by windfall profits for the oil from the oil company.
And what is the question here is, what is a windfall profit?
Precisely.
The term came about in the 1970s because of a switch from regulated prices to deregulated prices. But what, are you going to have windfall profits on home sales when the real estate market is hot? You know.
Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine, Ruth Marcus, The Washington Post, Byron York of National Review. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg, with help from Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from Softscribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.